All right, so we're looking at fermentation still on 21. And as I said, there's many versions of this that have evolved, but these are the two that we usually care about. What is the big deal about fermentation? Why does it exist? What does it accomplish? No idea?
To reoxidize?
Reoxidize what? It is true that it accomplishes reoxidation. Remember what we said would happen if you didn't have oxygen? That would shut down cellular respiration because the chains would fill, right? But that means no more electrons can be dropped off to the chain, which means eventually all the taxis would be full in reduced form. So that would shut down glycolysis even, which would kill the organism. So fermentation is a way to reoxidize NADH back into NAD+, so that glycolysis can continue. And fermentation by itself does not produce any ATP. It's glycolysis that's producing the ATP. But coupling fermentation with glycolysis allows glycolysis to continue because glycolysis requires empty taxis, NAD+. So in ethanol fermentation, like in yeast, what happens is that pyruvate that glycolysis is spitting out, which is a three-carbon compound, of course, gets decarboxylated into a two-carbon compound called acetaldehyde, which then gets converted into ethanol, not because the cell wants to produce ethanol, which is the alcohol, but because that's a way to allow NADH to drop off its electrons and become NAD plus again. Okay? So it's ethanol is just a byproduct of doing this. The purpose is to allow glycolysis to continue. But notice that CO2 comes off in the process. And this is why, as a, you know, if you brew beer, it's why it's not only alcoholic because of the ethanol that's produced, it's also carbonated because the CO2 is produced. In us, we don't, it's kind of a more direct process. We don't carboxylate our pyruvate. If we did, the CO2 that's produced would acidify our blood. Instead, we take the pyruvate that glycolysis produces and make that into lactate or lactic acid. And that accomplishes the same thing. It allows NADH to be reoxidized into NAD+. But the buildup of lactic acid is problematic. You have to deal with that. It's part of fatigue. You know, if as long as you have continuous fuel input, you could jog indefinitely because you can keep up with the demand for oxygen since your lungs can work well enough and your heart. But you can't sprint indefinitely. When you're sprinting, your demand for ATP is beyond the capacity to deliver enough oxygen to allow cellular respiration to happen. So all you can do is resort to fermentation. You don't make nearly as much ATP. And eventually the lactic acid builds up, and that's why you might want to continue sprinting, but your body's not going to let you. 22 is a figure that shows that the important thing is, or one important thing about this is that glycolysis is not part of cellular respiration, as some books imply, or erroneously state. Glycolysis is its own process that has to happen for the cell to remain alive. It happens whether cellular respiration occurs or not. But then we get to this fork in the road, which is pyruvate, the end of glycolysis. And so it's a decision is made, basically, a chemical decision in a sense. And this is the question that's asked. After glycolysis ends, is it should I go to cellular respiration or should I go to fermentation? Well, you've already learned that it's definitely worth it to go to cellular respiration. You make a lot more ATP. You're not going to make any more ATP if you go fermentation. All that allows you to stay alive. But the question basically boils down to, is a terminal electron acceptor, a final electron acceptor, available, which is what's required for cellular respiration? And like I said, in us and in most respiring organisms, that's oxygen. It wouldn't have to be oxygen in those other species that use something else, but that's what it's saying. O2 present? Yes. Go to cellular respiration because it's a big payoff. But if it's not, then glycolysis will be allowed to continue because a fermentation method, which depends on the species, is used to reoxidize the NADHs. 23 shows you the central pathway, as it's called, which is what we've been studying, right? The middle part of this, as a flowchart, illustrates glycolysis and then cellular respiration. And so all of that combined is the complete process we've been talking about, the complete oxidation of glucose. Well, glucose is the master fuel, as I've said. That's why we've studied it from the viewpoint of glucose. But glucose isn't the only possible fuel. On the top, we have the three major nutrient classes. Foods are made out of mostly these three categories of things: proteins, carbohydrates, and fats. And remember, carbohydrates can be either big things or small things. Monosaccharides, disaccharides, polysaccharides are all carbohydrates. Well, if you're eating a complex carbohydrate, like a polysaccharide, starch, for instance, that's not fuel by itself. You first have to digest it. Your digestive system, it's too big to get into your body. Your digestive system has to break it down into the individual glucoses. But then each of those glucoses can enter glycolysis like any glucose can. But there's other monosaccharides besides glucose. Well, they can feed into the process as well. For instance, you might recall that one of those steps of glycolysis is to convert glucose into fructose. Well, if your fructose is coming in from your food, you can just skip those steps and go to the fructose step. That's what this green arrow indicates, one of the intermediate steps. And the rest of it will remain the same. You'll get energy out of it. Fats are also an important nutrient class. And remember, fats are triglycerides. So they're four-part molecules: a glycerol and three fatty acids. And when you digest them, that's what they're broken down into. Glycerol itself is part of glycolysis, so it can feed in later than the beginning and be processed for energy. And fatty acids, well, remember what fatty acid is. It's really a hydrocarbon with a carboxyl at the end, right? And if you take two of the carbons at a time off of the tail — a fatty acid has so many carbons in it — if you take them off two at a time from a non-carboxyl end, the tail end, then that is an acetyl group. Those two carbons are just, and the associated atoms, are just like the two that get taken off of pyruvate in the first part of cellular respiration. So that can feed directly into cellular respiration, just like acetyl-CoA carries the acetyl that's what's left over from pyruvate. Fatty acids are valuable energy sources. Now, those are pretty straightforward, because those meaning carbohydrates and fats, because the only things they contain are oxygen, carbon, and hydrogen. Proteins can also be used as fuel, or the amino acids of proteins can be. But they're not typically used as fuel. Proteins are more of a permanent molecule. Not that they last forever in your body. You need protein continuously, but not nearly as much as you'd think, or are led to believe. There's Americans actually are taking in too much protein for their health. Can lead to problems. But anyway, the problem from the viewpoint of processing it as fuel is that there's carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, and nitrogen in proteins. And nitrogen is the problem. So, but proteins can be used as fuel. First, they have to be digested into the amino acids. Right? That's what the enzymes of digestion do. Every amino acid, by definition, has nitrogen in it. And nitrogen can't be part of this central pathway. So you have to deaminate or get rid of the amino group from the amino acid. That's why NH3, ammonia, is coming out. And that will leave stuff that has only carbon, hydrogen, and oxygen. And it depends on which amino acid we're talking about as to where it feeds into the process. But all of these carbon, hydrogen, and oxygen-containing things that come from amino acids can be used as fuel various places. The ammonia is a problem because it's toxic, and so we don't let it build up too much. Various animals do it different ways. Like fish, for instance, are continuous getting freshwater fish are just more or less continuously getting rid of ammonia directly in their urine. We don't let it build up. A major function of the liver, among its many functions, is to transform it into something that's not quite as toxic, which is urea. That'll build up and become a problem too, like in gout, which is exacerbated by eating too much protein. But anyway, that's that. The urea that is produced by the liver then goes to the kidneys and becomes part of the urine. We get rid of it that way. But mostly proteins are not treated as fuel unless you're starving. You know, if you starve, if you don't eat, first of all, you use all your carbohydrate stores. We have so much glycogen in our body. We'll run out in about a day, 2 days maybe. Then you'll start burning fats, however much fat you have stored. When you run out of that, then you start breaking down your muscles, which are mostly protein. And that's an emergency situation. All right, 24. Once again, we have this central pathway, the complete oxidation of glucose. But here we see feedback loops operating on it to control it. So we've learned how the pathway works, but importantly, you wouldn't want every cell to be running this pathway at full bore all the time, right? You want to run it at a rate that is appropriate for the conditions. Sometimes you need to ramp it up, sometimes you need to ramp it down, because it would be wasteful to keep it at full bore. And so we have these green and red arrows. The red ones are inhibitory, meaning they will turn down the pathway. So not as much ATP gets produced. Well, notice that ATP itself is an inhibitor. It will inhibit phosphofructokinase, which is one of the important enzymes in glycolysis. We talked about feedback inhibition already, right? Well, if you have a buildup of ATP, that means you're making too much. And so it will say, slow down. We have enough at the moment. Similarly, citrate, which is, remember, that's the first part of the citric acid cycle, oxaloacetate gets added to the acetyl that's coming in to produce the 6-carbon citrate. If there's too much of that, that's also a signal that you're running things too fast, and so it will inhibit. AMP, on the other hand, remember, is the form of the adenosine nucleotide that has the least energy. ATP is fully charged, or fully charged with energy. ADP still has usable energy in it, just not as much as ATP. And if your activity, the demand for energy, is greater than what than the ATP that's being produced, you're first going to use your ATP, and then you'll have a bunch of ADP, which can also be used. And when you use it for energy, you dephosphorylate it into AMP. And when AMP starts to build up, that is a strong signal to the body that you're not making enough ATP if we're using all the ADP. Because AMP is, in the money analogy, AMP is like a zero balance debit card. You want to put the deposit in. So it is a strong stimulator. AMP, if it's in high concentrations, will tell the cell, ramp this up to make a lot more ATP quickly. I think that's the chapter. Yes, it is.